Great. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. I think we have some stragglers here that will come in over the next few minutes, but I wanted to get started on time because we have lots to talk about. And I wanted to start by just welcoming our distinguished speaker, Sion Bailock, who I've gotten to know a bit over the last 3 or 4 months, who I think you're going to find is just a fascinating person and a great role model. So, Sion, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, Dave, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Great. We really are glad to have you. You have so much that we can talk about, but just by way of introduction, I know you all received the bio, but Sion is a really distinguished cognitive scientist, a real innovator and leader in the academic world, both from her time at University of Chicago and now in her leadership role as president of Barnard. And I have found her. We've had a number of conversations as she's gotten to know Bridgewater and I've gotten to know her a bit. Someone who's just a very wise and thoughtful advisor on our current moment in time as a country and some of the issues at the forefront. And so I'm really so glad to have you here. And before we get into some of those really sensitive topics that I really want to push towards, I thought maybe just you giving the audience a bit of background on how you went from aspiring soccer goalkeeper to cognitive scientist to president of one of the most prominent universities in the country.
Happy to. And I think it starts actually much earlier. I always talk about this moment in third grade where I wanted to play on the boys' soccer team. And they told my mom as we were signing up in the gym that I couldn't. I had to play on the girls' soccer team. And my mom, I grew up in a family of lawyers, and my mom pushed back and she questioned it. And I realized at that moment that you could question things and that you didn't have to just do what people told you, and that reasonable arguments could actually change people's minds. And so that sort of, I think, inspired me to always question everything and to seek knowledge. And that led me to my research, which is focused on human performance. And I always wanted to know what could lead to the best performance. And I certainly did research in addition to research. I was a high level athlete, and there was a lot of pressure in my family to perform at a high level. And sometimes I pulled out my best performance when everyone was watching, and sometimes I didn't. And so, I really went into this trying to understand what leads to optimal performance.
Well, when we started to talk about this initially, we were talking about it within the context of my kids and how to help them think about performance in athletics. And you directed me towards your TED Talk, which I noted has like 2 million viewings. So that's pretty great. But it was based a bit on your research, I think, in your book called Choke, which was really about performance anxiety and how to overcome that. I know that's just one thread of a rich research agenda that you've had, but can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, when I started this research, and I started in grad school and then really continued at the University of Chicago and then now at Barnard and Columbia, in psychology and organizational psychology and neuroscience, there was a lot of work on how people perform at their best, but there really weren't a lot of research or case studies about why people sometimes mess up and why you mess up in group settings. And so I was really interested in that. I was interested in when you appear to have all the tools for success, why you can't pull it out. And I mean, this is one of the reasons we love sports, because we're watching the most high level athletes and you don't know what they're going to do, right? If you always knew who was going to win a game, you wouldn't watch. And so my research program and what I've done, if you take away anything from it, it's that how we think about our ability to perform and how we think about others really matters. And it matters above and beyond anyone's individual skill or ability. And when you are worried about your own performance, it can change how your brain functions and you can perform poorly. And that's important to know, because then you can start figuring out how to fix it.
Well, we like to, we use metaphors here where we talk about ourselves as like, try to be an elite organization, not unlike a high powered professional sports team an elite unit of some kind. What are some of the lessons or suggestions? One of the things we talked about was this idea that and I've been trying this with my kids and myself a little bit, where you think about all the things, your advice, you talk about all the things you like about yourself or like about your life outside the event. And then that gave you, that sort of gave you a framing before you actually walked into the thing you had to perform at.
Yeah. I mean, I talk a lot about this idea of how we think about ourselves. Right. And, first of all, I think it's healthy to have skepticism about your own ideas and others' ideas, but you also have to be confident in what you're doing in the moment and be okay with failing, right? And part of what being okay with failing means is having an organization that doesn't punish you for failing, right? Because if you're sort of punished for failing or it's not seen as okay, it incents you not to take risks, not to put yourself out there. But you also have to not punish yourself for failing. And we tend to not be so compassionate with ourselves. We beat ourselves up after we do something wrong. We ruminate, we spotlight on it. We focus on it way more than other people are. And one way to get around that is to remind yourself that you have a lot of individual aspects that are not just your work self. Maybe you're a parent or a friend or something else. And actually reminding yourself of all your self complexities can take some of the pressure off. When I screw up majorly as a president or a researcher, and I fail all the time, you know, I can go home and hug my 9-year-old, or when she tells me I'm the worst mom ever, you know, I can look at a research paper or do something great at work. And it actually, there's a lot of psychological research showing that that can help with mental health and help us actually have a better outlook.
You know, I want to push this a little bit further into some of your research, and then I want to come back to, you know, how you guided your way through these different aspects of your career. But one of the things you talk about in your research is imposter syndrome, and we've had some conversations here internally about that. We've had some broader discussions among some of our key people here. Could you talk a little bit about what that is? Is it unique to women, or is it broader based? I know some of your research in particular is focused on women, and just give us your perspective on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll just tell you also how I define imposter syndrome, right? It's this sort of worry that you've tricked everyone into being where you are, or thinking that you have what it takes to succeed. And then you worry when you're in the moment that they're going to sort of discover you as an imposter. And it's interesting, if you look back at the research, it started focused on women, but it's a total misnomer that it's only women. Everyone, I guarantee you, everyone listening has had imposter syndrome at one point or another, right? You worry that you're not going to be able to show what you know, or people are going to find out you don't know as much as you do, or you're not the smartest person in the room. And the reason this matters is because when we worry, our brain changes. And we've shown this in our research. We look at people worrying all the time in different tests. One of my favorite is to have people do math who are worried about math. You actually see physiological changes in the brain when people are freaking out about something. And the idea is that when you're worrying, you don't get the best out of people, because it's like you're doing two things at once. You're driving and talking on the cell phone, which we know is not a good idea. And so the question is, how do you help individuals create situations where they're not worried about what other people are thinking about them? And then as organizations, can you put in place mechanisms to help build a culture where people are willing to stick their neck out there and not worried necessarily about the consequences?
Yeah. And as you're sort of thinking about that, and, you know, one of your, you know, great missions today is to help younger people begin to navigate their professional lives and professional careers. Maybe what advice might you give to our team here, but in particular, those people that are in the early formative years of their career? They're ambitious, they're trying to find their way and navigate their way successfully through.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something I think about every day at Barnard, right? We are one of the most selective institutions in the country, and most of our young women show up never having failed at anything. And one piece of advice is that it's okay to be uncomfortable. And actually, you have to learn to be okay with that fear and uncomfortableness. We talk a lot about how even physiological symptoms like that sweaty palms and beating heart, it's the same physiological response when you're excited, like when someone's proposing to you or you're at a birthday party, as when you're worried, right? And so if you could start to recognize that as a sign that you're ready to go rather than a sign you're ready to fail, it can actually change how you perform. But I would also say, and I say a lot, I talk a lot about my own failures when I talk to Barnard students and when I talk to young people. I think find anyone who you think is successful and talk to them. And I guarantee their path is not a linear line. I guarantee they didn't get jobs they wanted and failed at things that they really thought they could do and made huge mistakes. And there is something really important about getting used to being able to go down the wrong path and correct yourself. And I think that's one of the strongest skills we need. And unfortunately, I think it's often lacking in young people.
Yeah, no, we talk about that a lot here because it requires either within your own mind or even broadly embracing the vulnerabilities and embracing the failures, which I've certainly had my share of here, including an epic firing as the CEO earlier in my career. Tell us about that through your eyes. So what are the things that you struggle with when you talked about the me search and the research? How did the two come together in terms of your own journey?
Yeah, well, I had, one of the worst soccer games in my life in front of the Olympic coach who was looking at the team. So that sort of sparked it all. There were a lot of times in my life I never tested as well on the SAT or the GRE as I did in practice. And I have certainly been in conversations and in talks where I just have blundered through. Right. And I made decisions as a president that I wouldn't make now that I've learned from. And so, I keep on going back to, and I think I've told the story to someone at Bridgewater, but several years ago, I sat on a committee that was put together by the National Academy of Sciences at the request of OSHA to look at how coal miners escape in disasters. Because there have been several really high profile coal mining disasters, and the lore of the day was just for the coal miners to stay put and not try and get out. And that wasn't working, right? So they brought together psychologists, astronauts, engineers to really develop new training standards. And one of the things that we came to really quickly is that there are certain practices that essentially don't condone failure. And one of them is counterintuitive, like at the coal plant or the mining company, they put up a sign, 60 days since an accident, 75 days since an accident. It was sort of essentially celebrating not having any blips or failures. And what we found is that that actually caused people not to report when things were going wrong. And so how can we retrain that to understand that it's okay to report things that are going wrong, that we have to fix them in the moment? And by trying to celebrate this perfect roll of streak of safety, it actually was counterintuitive in that way. So in my own life with my senior team at Barnard and in other situations with my students, with companies I work with, I make it a point that it's really important for leaders to focus on when they failed and what they've done. It really sets a stage.
Yeah. And just for me and for us, as we think about that at Bridgewater, any advice from your own experience or from your research about steps one might take to create that kind of culture to reinforce those institutional norms? I mean, we talk about that a lot here about failure being at the root of progress and evolution and so forth. But what have you learned?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that is really important is for leaders to be talking about it. Here are three or four failures that have happened in the last month or in the last few months, and here's what we've done about it. The idea is almost, as we talk about in child psychology, to develop a growth mindset in the company, right? Not that you are a fixed mindset is one where you either have it or you don't. Whether you're smart or not, you're successful or not. And a growth mindset is more on the idea of that you can get better with practice. And it turns out when kids hold growth mindsets, they're actually more likely to try challenges. They're more likely to stick their neck out. And so it's about creating that in the company. And one of the great ways to do it, I think, is to actually celebrate some of those failures, talk about them, digest them. So it's kind of the opposite of putting up the 60 days since no accident sign and talking about it the other way.
Yeah, that's good advice. I just want to encourage people that are listening to put your questions in the chat, and then I'm going to turn to the last 20 minutes or so and direct your questions to Siam. One last final question in your career and your own experiences. What role did mentors play? Were there key people that helped guide your path along the way, helped you sort through your failures and the decisions you made?
Yeah, and I'm glad you're asking that now because I think it comes back to what you were asking before about what you can do as a company to help sort of reinforce the belief that it's okay to take risks and it's okay not to get everything right. And I think mentors play a huge role in that. You know, it's one thing to have a very public failure and not have any sort of private space to process it. And we know anyone who's seen a psychologist or keeps a journal knows the power of processing information, and having someone there to process it with you can be really great. And so I think mentors come into play in these sorts of situations. And, you know, maybe even just-in-time mentors when something happens, when there's, you know, an issue that happens in a meeting or someone goes in the wrong direction, having just-in-time mentors to come in and help someone process what's happened and find the path forward can be really helpful. For me, hands down, my biggest mentor has been Bob Zimmer, who's the president of the University of Chicago. I got to know him when I was an assistant professor at Chicago. I sat on a committee that advised the president and provost. It was 12 of us. And he I've never seen an individual who has been so good at sort of having a compass that leads where he's going. He certainly listens to other individuals. But he really had a compass and an idea around the University of Chicago. I think a lot of us know about it, around what the university stands for in terms of free expression and the exchange of ideas. And I learned a lot from watching him, first as a faculty member and then as an officer of the university and in the provost office, sort of keeping, always coming back to that compass, not losing his own ideals or the ideals of the institution he was leading.
Yeah, we've talked about him. He's really, you know, he's really quite a prominent voice in higher ed, because of the very point you made, where he seemed to have a moral compass, and that manifested itself. And I guess it's the Chicago principles and the, you know, which was a really affirming statement around the freedom of expression, and really a counter balance to cancel culture, which was very, as it continues to be a very prominent issue on campuses. Can you talk about what the issue was? It's been written about a lot, but talk about the issue, talk about how he brought people together to bring, you know, come to agreement on a set of principles that would guide how the community operated.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that higher education, and I think our society in general, is in a precarious position right now. And there's, you know, as we talk about cancel culture, I think there's been a real move over the last several years to the idea that people shouldn't, some people hold the view that people shouldn't speak if they're offensive to others. And the University of Chicago, this is, wasn't invented by Bob Zimmer, but what he did was iterate on what had been principles since the founding. So since its founding, the Chicago had been a place where speakers had been on campus that other some people hadn't liked. And you can see it iterate throughout history. And what I found so interesting about the approach that we all took in as administrators is that we went to the faculty. It wasn't something that was just done on high. Like, Bob didn't just say, here are the principles. He convened a group of faculty to reiterate the Chicago principles, working from the past. And if you go read the Stone Report, which Jeff Stone was the chair, who's a professor of law, what you see from the beginning of it, and I encourage everyone to read it, is it reiterates the history and why at this moment in time they were writing these principles. It wasn't out of the blue. It created a source for why they were doing it, and then the reasons why it was so important. And it essentially, you know, his ideas, much like the ideas of Bridgewater, that you can't get to the best ideas if you don't have a free and open exchange. And that, in fact, is going to be uncomfortable a lot. And he wasn't the first to say that. Hannah Gray, who's the first female president of Chicago, one of the first women in the Ivy Plus, just an amazing person, gave a whole speech several years before, which the Stone Report recounted, where she said, the purpose of education is not to be comfortable. And so they went back and took that. And I think the power of the Stone Report is that it pulls history up and then it builds on it. And it's, you know, been a really important guiding beacon for what happens at the institution and for other institutions, though,
And
frankly.
did in the end, did the, you know, did fac the faculty come together behind it? How did he deal with differing perspectives on that? Because I think it was stimulated by some controversial speakers or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's been several controversial speakers. speakers at many, at all institutions, but it was stimulated by sort of a resurgence in people asking for this sort of cancel culture. And a great example of when the Stone Report actually was very useful is when a business school faculty invited Steve Bannon to speak on campus, and a lot of people were just horrified with this, right? And Bob was able to point to the Stone Report and say, I hear you're horrified, I get it, but this is, you know, this is a place where we listen to horrific ideas and then we deal with it. And so I think, you know, it's a touchstone in that way. But the question of how it got done, again, was that it wasn't dropped from on high. It was iterated through a faculty committee that talked to people across the college. And not everyone agrees with it, right? It's still contentious. And I don't think there has to be 100% buy-in, but there has to be a clear process and a clear reason why you're doing this. And then it can be helpful. And even if you don't agree with all aspects of it, it's at least a shared way to start the conversation.
Well, just taking another step on higher ed, and then I want to turn to sort of the broader issues within society, which I know you're spending a lot of time thinking about in your role. But it's been a tumultuous year for higher ed. Yeah. Some fundamental norms about how education is supposed to take place have been tested. And, you know, as we've discussed together, you've learned a lot and been able to pull it off pretty magically at Barnard. And we've learned a lot, too. What are the key takeaways from the last 12 months of the stress test? And what are the implications for the future of higher education?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't know if everyone would agree with this, but my key takeaway is that there's not a one-size-fits-all way to do education. And certainly what the pandemic has done has helped speed up that realization. So, I mean, Barnard is a residential institution. It's essentially an honors college, and we're small compared to large public institutions. And we take a very small proportion of the students who we could educate, who would be fantastic at Barnard. And so for me, the question now is, how do we reach a broader audience if they're not going to be residential? Even alums, I think it's very clear that education is lifelong now, whether institutions are credentialing after or helping. In my case, I think we're focusing a lot on women coming in and out of the workforce, which is very hard. And the pandemic has certainly sped that up. So we're looking in two ways. One is our alums, our 35,000 women, a lot of them who have come in and out of the workforce, and how we can help them on that next step. And then we're looking earlier. We know we can do online education. We know it's not the same, but imagine if you could reach the most low-income schools and pull the best and brightest kids out of there and give them an experience at a Barnard class where they could actually get college credit and then maybe use that as a stepping stone, either to Barnard or somewhere else. And so we're also focused on that and really excited about it. So we're in high schools starting next year, high schools who are 100% free and reduced lunch, the most low-income schools, where we will have Barnard faculty teaching a course asynchronously, and then TAs working with students who've been selected by their counselors, the brightest young women who we're hoping as a stepping stone will help expand education. And I think every college and university has a responsibility here, and we all have to be focusing on this.
Yeah, tell me more about that, because I was going to ask you about, I know we share the view that the opportunity gap in our country is really one of our biggest challenges. What has the thing you just described meant in actual results? Like how should one think about the composition of your incoming classes? How does one think about financial aid? How do you balance all those things to put together a recipe for the right ingredients of a great class of women at Barnard?
Yeah, I mean, there's not one key formula. And of course, Barnard is constrained because historically, you know, we were started on an idea, not an endowment, like most higher education institutions. But we believe more than anything that you can't have the best ideas unless you're not looking at money as a criteria for coming in. So we're need blind. We need full financial aid. And we do it on a shoestring. But I'm pleased to say that 60% of our incoming class are identified as women of color. We have a diverse class, and we get ranked continuously as one of the best institutions in social mobility. So we're looking for a diverse class. We don't do quotas, we don't do numbers. We're looking for the best and brightest combination to come to the table. And we do that, we feel we have to do that without looking at financial ability to pay, or we're going to be looking through a lens that's not the correct one.
Well, and also you do it within the context of being one of the most prominent, and you know there aren't that many women's colleges in the country. And I wondered if you might talk a little bit about the importance of that kind of institution. We had the President Morehouse here. We talked about, you and I talked about this, President Morehouse here, I don't know, a few months ago. And then also talk, if you could tie it to your research on math and science, women's education for math and science, because I know one of your sources of great pride is the composition of your class in terms of the disciplines and what they take into the workforce.
Yeah. So let me just step back and say Barnard is like a very unique, I think not, I didn't understand really what Barnard was before I got there. So we're our own institution focused on women's leadership with our own endowment, our own trustees, but we have this amazing relationship with Columbia such that all our classes are cross-listed. So people go from Columbia to Barnard and back. Our faculty are all tenured at Barnard and Columbia. And our students get diplomas at both institutions. So they come out, even though we're separate institutions, it's kind of the best of both worlds. And people ask me a lot, like, do you need a women's education? Is it special? And I actually don't think there's any magic secret sauce. And I know that might seem odd to hear from me, but there are things that tend to happen at Barnard that I think could happen anywhere that we know result in outcomes with our students going out in really high numbers in STEM fields and fields where the women aren't traditionally represented. And I think there's three of them. One is seeing people like you. It seems simple, but when you see people like you in leadership roles, there is so much evidence that you start to believe you can do it. It's very clear. The second is that we challenge norms and we talk about it. Why are men overrepresented at the highest ends of math and science? Is there any biological reason that should be? I mean, I don't think so. I think the data are pretty clear that number and math is recent, is a recent evolutionary invention, and it's duct taped onto the area that controls your fingers. And there's no difference in finger dexterity. So why should there be any difference in number and math from a biological reason? But there's certainly differences in socialization. And then the third, it's like hitting a tennis ball against a wall. When you do it a lot, you just become automatic at it. And when you are in a class that has more women in it, women tend to be more likely to raise their hand, to speak out. They do it automatically. And when they're in more co-ed environments, they don't think about twice about their gender. And so I think all of these things could happen in any institution. I just think they tend not to. So I don't think there's a secret sauce, but I will say that our women are special and they come out with an amazing voice. I had to put that plug in.
For sure. Well, listen, the questions are piling up in the chat room, which doesn't surprise me. Let me actually ask you one more question, because I think this will maybe be my last chance to have my own questions answered, and it's really about advice or modeling. For I know you consult with professional athletes and CEOs and a number of others. And you, if you were focused on workplace and trying to create a work, there's a question for me in the chat, which I'll try to answer in a bit, but trying to create a workplace where people could bring their best selves, could fail and grow and evolve, where imposter syndrome was discouraged, or the conditions were put in place to help people not feel that. Who are the models, and what advice do you have?
Yeah. So the models of other institutions, for example.
Yeah. Other institutions, other leaders.
Yeah.
Your present company included or excluded. I know you focus on this a lot, but any advice, anyone you'd advise we look to, or any specific advice you'd give?
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking about what companies I think do this well. And just in the current moment, I think one great example of a company that has really changed a view of an industry and come out in a totally different light is Pfizer. In terms not only of their vaccine development, but in terms of how they've talked about what it means in terms of equity of the vaccine. You know, equity is not always appropriate in my mind. I think making sure that you're focusing on having the best ideas at the table and people feel like they can bring those ideas forward is really important. But equity in terms of vaccine distribution seems like a no-brainer, and it protects everyone. And I think Pfizer has done an amazing job from an industry that was not being looked at really in a great way of talking about how they are working to get the vaccine everywhere and working to get it independent of whether a country can pay the same as the US. So I think in terms of reputation, thinking who Pfizer has in terms of their top leaders, they have a woman who's their chief science officer. They have a chief patient officer, which they just brought in. I think, and also being very clear about when they were doing trials, including a population that was representative of the population, rather than just focusing on what a lot of trials have been, which are white upper class people. I think they have done an amazing job in terms of using the moment to express their core values.
What about internally? You know, in terms of creating the safe spaces, you know, you made the point, which I take to be a very good piece of advice around leaders expressing their own failures, talking about the challenges in a very open way, so it becomes conditioning. It's like swimming in the cold water. But what else might you advise?
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes back to the University of Chicago idea that like the classroom or maybe even the meeting room, it's totally fine to be uncomfortable. But the idea that you do need some spaces to fall back on comes from psychological research, right? When you're in a place where you feel stress and pressure, you have a cognitive load. And just like any muscle, you need to taper, you need to relax over time. So I know you do this at Bridgewater, but thinking really systematically about affinity groups you have and who's in those affinity groups, I often think that there's a real power in, you know, if you have a group focused on women, also having men who feel, who are mentors or feel some responsibility to it. But I think it's important to create spaces where you can kind of take that load off because it helps you be a better performer. It's the same in athletics. You would not practice the same muscle every day, right? You need to step back and let it rest. And if we're cognitively always under the gun, we don't get our best performance. So we need mechanisms to step back and take that pause and talk to people with all of our guards down. And I think, you know, it's nice to say that should happen in the boardroom and in the meeting room and everything should be on the table. But in reality, I don't think that always happens. And we have to think about how we counter it otherwise. And I would just give one more piece of advice because I'm an academic and I like to talk. And I think one of the biggest issues in companies that I've seen and even in athletic organizations is a breakdown when things go wrong is a breakdown in communication. We're very good at thinking that other people understand exactly what we're thinking because we're thinking it. But when we're worse at sort of predicting whether people understand what we're trying to get at. And I worry with email and everything digital that we lose some of the back and forth that really allows people to understand and us to understand if we're getting our point across. And so I think that's something really important to consider, especially in hard-driving organizations.
Great. I'm going to draw on as a first question from one of our members of our community who's a Barnard grad.
Love it.
Sophia Lyons. Just, and it's a really an add-on or a follow-on to the answer you just gave. She's class of 17. Oh. And really,
so I missed her.
Yeah. So, so this is great. And she wanted to just sort of, I think it's an extension of what you were just talking about, but maybe just to put it in her words, when you're trying to foster a growth mindset and help people learn from mistakes, and at the same time, trying to give really tough critical feedback, how do you strike that balance? Because, you know, we're very feedback intensive here. And, you know, if anything, we're worried that our willingness to give tough feedback is slipping a bit in terms of like the directness and the candor, which has really been one of the things that we think has been really core to our success. But how do you, on, you know, Tuesday, say, man, you really screwed that up. You're, you know, talk honestly and openly about attributes and weaknesses and challenges. And then on Wednesday say, but you know, go forth and, you know, take risk and have that growth mindset. Any more coaching on getting that balance right?
Yeah. I mean, I think something that's so important is to talk not about the individual necessarily, but what they did, right? So the process. So here's what I think went wrong. this could be indicative of the fact that you need to focus more on X, Y, or Z rather than you are a bad person or you don't have this skill, right? You can talk about the skill they need to acquire, but in a way that it's not just about them having it or not. And that's really the difference, right? So if you mess something up, let's go back and unpack the process. What went bad? And now what are the attributes of yourself that we need to work on rather than what are we working on as you as a person, right? If you can break it down in that way into meaningful, manageable things, then there's something to focus on. I think when people sort of withdraw and step back is when they don't feel like they have control over anything they can change. And that control, feeling like there's a path forward, is so important. And in these tough conversations, I often suggest an initial conversation and a follow-up, because I think oftentimes people just need time to digest. It's kind of like that really nasty email you write to someone when you're really mad, but you don't send. And then you step back and you sort of reevaluate the situation. There is a power in having that time, taking that break, stepping back. And so I always suggest when you're having those tough conversations, and it allows that freedom in that conversation to have a follow-up at the end of the day or the next day. That way you can understand what they heard, which probably isn't 100% what you meant to say, because we're all not perfect at listening, right? I think we all, you know, we talked about this yesterday, David, listening is an important skill, which I think, you know, is undervalued, but we're also not perfect at giving feedback, right? It's something you practice over time. And so having that actual check-in to iterate again can be so important. And I think I've seen in companies where they put policies like that in place or practices more like that in place, and it ends up giving people more freedom to give the tough feedback because it's not the last conversation. You can come back.
Yeah, but that's you're making an interesting point, and I'd love to sort of explore it for a second just within the context of the cognitive science, because we historically have not focused on the thing as much as the person. We focused on the person. And the logic of that, for better or for worse, was you can tell somebody they threw a bad pass, and boy, you threw another bad pass, and not get to the point where, you know, you're not a very good football player, or you're not the right person to do that job, or your limitations here, you're going to have to, you know, you can't will yourself out of that. You're going to either have to find a way to overcome that weakness, which is probably outside your ability. You're going to have to partner with somebody or do something, or you're going to have to align yourself or your best into a role where your best self comes to the surface. So for that reason, we've, you know, historically gone, no, that, you know, you're struggling because you're not creative enough, or you're not X or Y, and how to get that message right is always, you know, the question. Do you see that differently, or do you see some wisdom in that approach?
So, I mean, I guess I would say that, right, just diagnosing the bad past doesn't change the bad past, right? Just saying, oh, you threw the bad past, right? So now what's the process? Why did you throw the bad past? Now, it could be you're not creative enough, or you're not athletic enough, or your arm isn't as developed enough. But I'd argue your arm not being as developed enough is very different than saying you're not a good football player.
Yeah.
Because the developed enough gives you a path, right? Right.
Fair point.
And it may be that your arm's never going to be developed enough, so you need to play tight end or play another position. And that's fine too. But it's really, I think there is a real important distinction between focusing on the aspect of the person they can develop, or they need someone else to help come in and support, versus just saying, oh, you're not a good football player.
Good. I agree. And so I'm hearing you say getting to that diagnosis of the why they keep throwing bad passes is really important.
But I would start with the bad pass.
Yeah.
And then go from there. And yes, I agree that diagnosis is really important, because what you don't want is for them to keep on throwing bad passes.
Yeah, good. That's clarifying. We've got a number of people who have asked some questions about parenting and helping your children confront the failures and learn from them and sort of creating that kind of norm. I know you look at this question both as a parent and a scientist. What can you tell us?
So I think one of the biggest things that we fail to do as parents, I will not generalize here, even though there is research, this tends to happen, but I'll just talk about myself because I think that's a safer space to be in and people can agree or not, is that we want to get involved and sort of prevent the struggle. And I think it's one of the worst things we can do for our kids. There's so much research, for example, showing that when girls struggle in math, the parents are more likely to get involved than when boys struggle. Regardless of, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, it's just sort of you come in, at least in the US, and to the bad outcomes, because the kid takes that as a sign they can't do it and then doesn't get the idea that some productive struggle is helpful for getting to an outcome. And so I catch myself all the time. We're successful people. We want to have successful kids. We don't like it when they're upset. And it's hard not to jump in and sort of course correct. But I think some good, healthy sort of not making the team, having a really bad game and being okay with it, and then figuring out what you're going to do different the next time or how you have to practice differently is actually really important.
Good. Eric raises a question, which I think is good. And I'll just use his words. You mentioned that when selecting students for Barnard, you don't do quotas, and you don't do that, but the decisions are based on merit. As a Black person, when I hear the word merit, when used within the context of minority issues and equity, it's almost always used to indicate the diversity or increasing minority representation automatically leads to a decrease in quality or compromising merit. Is there ever a time in the decision about the makeup of an organization when quotas are necessary?
I have to say I'm not a quota person. I think that you have to make some decisions about what makes a good organization. And I think it's important to have those pieces out in front. Like for me, Barnard is about one thing, that's academic excellence. And I fully believe that you can't have academic excellence unless you have a diversity of lived experiences and a diversity of opinions at the table. So you can't have the one without the other, which means that you have to create a class that brings that together. And so the question for me is, how do you do that combination? First of all, I will put the caveat on that I don't select the students. So I just have a really great job of touting the amazing students that we have that come to Barnard. But I think that, you know, then you're looking for a range of attributes that will lead to that makeup of that class. It's not just SAT scores. It's not just grades. It is looking at different paths people took. And I think we also have to be comfortable with the fact that we don't have perfect measurements. We know, for example, that the SAT has a huge socioeconomic component to it, that you can practice to the test. It's not a perfect measurement. And so by stating the principles of what we want to get and then looking at this sort of holistic way of selecting our students and being clear that we can't measure everything and our measures are always evolving, I think we get to where we need. But I don't think we do that with any lack of overall success in our student body or quality or where they go on. I certainly think that it means that we select people who come with different levels of preparation and we have to adjust for that sometimes. But it doesn't mean the outcome's going to be any different.
Great, thank you. This question is from Tyler, and he's questioning or asking you to differentiate if it's appropriate to differentiate between failure at sports and learning versus dealing with failure or a challenging work environment. Is the performance anxiety and dealing with that different? Are they different mental maps? How would you differentiate between the two?
Yeah, I don't think we choke any differently whether we have a golf club or a pencil in our hand. And that's always been an important part of my work. You know, looking across education, the business world, professional baseball players and golfers, basketball players. I think, you know, we choke in some and have performance anxiety in some very universal ways. And so why I think that's so neat in a way is that we can use insights from dealing with high level athletic teams to think about, you know, how to get companies to perform at their best level. And I think companies should be looking at what goes great in other industries and what doesn't, and academics should be doing the same thing. And so I think, you know, we have some universals about failure, and we can do it in all these different situations. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a high pressure situation to see that failure. I choke every time, and this is, you know, I guess probably stereotypical, but I'll say it anyway. I choke every time my husband's in the car when I'm trying to parallel park. I'm an excellent parallel parker when he's not watching. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be something high stakes. When all eyes are on you and your performance changes because you're worried about what someone else is going to think, you know, that's a choke.
Got it. Terrific. Let's see. Women's spaces. So you talked a little bit about Barnard as a women's institution, but maybe a bit as we think about Bridgewater and our affinity groups and so forth. Is there magic in creating all women's spaces within a larger organization like Bridgewater? Any thoughts on that, advice, research, and how you would think about it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we've talked about this before, that I think affinity groups can be really important as sort of a place to get rid of that cognitive load of always being in a space where you're having to perform. And I think, you know, it's a place to find mentors and have continue frank conversations that I hope you're having outside of those spaces. But, you know, I think there's a good amount of research showing that when you have an affinity group that doesn't have any connection to the rest of the organization, it's sometimes not seen as part of that organization. So I would ask, as you think about the affinity groups you have, for example, around women, how do men get involved? Are there mentorships that go outside the just having women mentors? What are you doing to connect it explicitly to the rest of the organization? And I have to say, my view on this changed when I got to Barnard and at Chicago too. I thought, you know, why do we need a space for the Latinx club? Why do they need their own space? Why can't they all be in the space with everyone else? Or why do we need an office devoted to first generation college students? And I thought it was sort of doing them a disservice or like ghettoizing it in a way. And my view really changed from talking to students who just talked about, you know, it's a cognitive load always to have to navigate and feel like you're asking the wrong questions. And having someone you can talk to who comes from the same sort of background, or you can have the same, this sort of really all out conversation, helps you get the energy back in a way. And I've changed my tune about that. I think it's true. I think it, you know, we don't think about it in that way, at least at Barnard. You don't think about the fact that someone who is coming from a family who's never been in a four-year institution doesn't even know how to address necessarily the professor. Do you call them professor, doctor? What does it mean to go to office hours? All of these things end up being a mental load. And if you can get rid of some of that load so they can focus their brain power, why not do it?
I wanted to go back to Tyler's question about the difference between choking or performance anxiety in sports versus the workplace. And I asked you this yesterday, sort of teased you about it, in terms of your clients that are professional athletes. And I said, you know, what can you tell me? And you said, well, you're not able to share any names, but is there a story or two that you might point to in terms of, you know, because we see these people on TV and everybody looks cool and calm, and just what kinds of things have you experienced in that capacity? I thought that's very atypical to most of the college presidents around in terms of who they're hanging out with.
Yeah. I mean, I've learned a lot from some of the professional athletes I've worked with. You know, I mean, I'll just say that I have one client in a sport, I'm not going to name the sport, who's, you know, had such a successful career, but really focused on making the Hall of Fame. Right? That is his only focus now. And he's put so much pressure on himself over the last few years. You know, it's sort of, he signed his last contract, you know, and he's lost any sort of, when I started working with him, he'd lost any sort of joy of the game, right? Because this had been his whole thing. And all he was focused on is what every play meant in terms of whether or not he'd be considered for the Hall of Fame. So what we've been doing is working on, focusing on the near term, right? What the next game means, what the next play means, and techniques to sort of keep him in the present. And there's, you know, I'm not the first to come up with this. Entire Eastern cultures around meditation and mindfulness think about being in the present and how it helps your ability to perform. And we give him techniques, right? Even focusing on something like his pinky toe as he goes into a play, or something that can help keep him grounded. A T word mantra. And I'm pleased to say that he's playing much better and what he wants me is, it looks like it's in reach.
That's pretty good. Well, you get to go to the ceremony. this sort of taps into a question from Fabio, which was, any research or sort of habits that you can point to as ways of, you know, sort of overcoming any changes you need to make? What, you know, some people exercise, some people meditate, as you say. So is any things you suggest, or said differently, are there any things you need to change or overcome to be able to, you know, position yourself to be able to perform better?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan in documenting and journaling and actually keeping a list. So we know that actually journaling about your worries and your fears can take sort of this mental load off. And people who journal, it's been shown to in studies to help with depression. Actually journaling with depressed individuals is negatively related to the number of serious doctor's visits they have for their illness. Like, there's some really power in sort of getting your thoughts down on paper. But I'm a big fan of this for wanting to make a change. And I think, you know, we know from psychology, like around dieting or exercise, that it's oftentimes those big things in the future just seem unattainable, or they're not so motivating because they're far out in the future. And we tend to discount things that are so far out in the future. So how do you create a situation and remind yourself of a situation of something that is good today or tomorrow? How do you give yourself that immediate gratification, which we know humans like? And actually keeping a goal list for that day and checking it can be a great way to keep yourself on track. And instead of just saying, you know, oh, I've got to lose 10 pounds and it's out in the future, or I have to be more X, Y, or Z and it's out in the future, make it real concrete.
So small steps, near-term vision in terms of focus.
Yeah, I think that's one great tool.
Yeah, terrific. Well, I've got a couple more questions. I had a question directed to me from Morgan, which I'll try to answer briefly, and then I'll turn back to Sian. The question is, David, I'm curious if you feel like we are successfully creating this environment for women to succeed at Bridgewater, where people can fail with support and where imposter syndrome isn't fostered. And the answer on that is, I'm not sure if we're successfully creating it. I think we're trying to create it. Talks like this, you know, the effort we put into the conversations, we had a number of extremely prominent women in Bridgewater who are getting all sorts of recognition. And I think talking openly about their challenges and failures, which are serving as great role models. But it's very much a journey. And so conversations like this, Morgan, are sort of meant in part to give us all exposure to a great thoughtful person in this area, but it's also to learn. And, you know, one of the things Sian and I have been talking about is ways to get her involved in Bridgewater so I can tease out things that we can do better. And so I'd say probably not successfully, but certainly we're very committed to trying to continue to make this a great community for everybody to succeed. So with that, let me go to Regan's question, which is a little more neuroscience focused, but Regan makes the point that there's been a lot of talk here within Bridgewater. Ray spent a lot of time talking about this. We've had other speakers talking about neuroscience and brain science and connecting psychological safety to neuroscience learning and so forth. All in an effort to help people deal with the stress of the moment and not to trigger their amygdalas. Can you talk about that a bit? I know your research touches on all that stuff, but we haven't really hit it directly.
Yeah, so I'm going to tell you about one of my favorite research findings that was done by one of my PhD students at the time at Chicago, who's now an assistant professor at Georgetown. So all my great research ideas have come in collaboration with other individuals. And I think my most exciting moments are when my PhD students and postdocs have amazing ideas and do amazing projects with me. But we actually put people in an MRI, which is a big magnet, a brain scanner. And we were interested in what we saw in terms of what was happening in the brain when they did something that they're really scared of or that created pressure. And what is so interesting about our findings is that in the actual moment, the brains are not as telling as right before, right? So where we see the biggest differences between people who are scared of something and people who are not, or people who are nervous and people who are not, is when they know something scary is about to come. It's sort of the what ifs. It's the night before. It's the lack of control of knowing what's going to happen. And why I think that's so important is that it suggests that if you can provide some control or at least some parameters, here are the principles we operate by, here's the shared understanding, then that lack of control goes down and some of those what ifs go down. So I think it's really a missed opportunity if we're not talking about the preparation that time before. And because of this, you know, with a lot of the athletes I work with and other individuals, that 20 minutes before you're going to give a big talk or go into an important meeting is supposed to be just, you should be distracting yourself. You should be doing something, not cramming for what you're about to do. I like to read, you know, the news or something that just sort of takes my mind off. I know one professional athlete does crossword puzzles right before she skis a race. You know, it's that moment before where your amygdala and your cingulate cortex and all of the areas involved in your sort of fight or flight, you know, the run up the tree go off, and the idea is to calm them down. And one thing we know that helps calm them down, aside from doing crossword puzzles or that 20 minutes, is knowing a little bit of what to expect. What's the worst that could happen? Here are the shared understanding. Even if I fall on my face, it's not the end of my career. I can work on something. And that actually can do a lot to put that amygdala, not to sleep, but to make sure it's not running the show.
When I was in college, the sports psychologist and the coaches would always say right before a match, you would visualize the end where you'd have your arm being lifted that you won and all that stuff. Is there anything to that in terms of science? Is it like visualizing success and winning right before you do something?
So I'm a fan of visualization. I think it's great as long as you're visualizing good things. You know, we oftentimes can have these visualizations where we start worrying about the bad. But you know, what I think visualization does is get you to focus on why you should succeed, right? And what the end result could be, rather than just letting yourself be there and focus on why you should fail. And so I would even recommend right before, the visualization isn't the best thing. You should just step back and do something else. But I think focusing and thinking about as you're preparing why you should succeed. I remember I gave a talk at the National Academy of Sciences, a lot of scary people who I'm sure were a lot smarter than me. And I just kept on reminding myself that I know my research better than anyone else. I know what I'm talking about. And that's actually really important. Like, we don't have to let our thoughts get the best of us. We can actually control our narrative. And the fact of the matter is that our narrative matters. When we dwell on the negative, there are biological changes in how we think and perform. And so changing our mindset actually matters. It's not just some mystical thing. It actually changes how we learn and perform.
Well, that is a perfect line to end on. I'm going to go think big positive things. This was great. I really appreciate you taking time with us. It's exactly what I'd hoped we would do, is really cover a broad range of topics. And most important, I really wanted the chance to introduce a broader group of Bridgewater people to you, because I'm, as you and I have talked about, I'm hoping we can get you more involved in Bridgewater and take advantage of your great insights. So thank you for spending time with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me spend time. It's been really fun, and Bridgewater is certainly a very special place. There's no doubt about that.
Well, thanks for saying that. Have a great day. See you soon, Sion. Bye-bye.